Welcome to the Mayo Clinic Ophthalmology Podcast on all things ophthalmology brought to you by Mayo Clinic. I'm your host, Dr. Andrea Tooley.
And I'm Dr. Eric Bothan. We're here to bring you the latest and greatest in ophthalmology, medicine, and more.
Today we are joined by Dr. John Chen, neuro-ophthalmology expert for a journal club. We are going to be talking about two articles very important within neuro-ophthalmology, one focused on diagnosis of myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein-associated international MOGAD panel proposed criteria, all about MOGAD and optic neuritis, and another about the effect of GLP receptor antibodies, exenatide, on idiopathic intracranial hypertension, a randomized clinical trial. Two super important articles. We're really happy to have Dr. Chen today.
Dr. John Chen is an MD, PhD, and professor of ophthalmology and neurology here at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He is a past president of the Minnesota Academy of Ophthalmology, chairman of the Upper Midwest Neuro-Ophthalmology Group, AAO Leadership Development Program graduate, and is an editorial board member of Neuro-Ophthalmology. We frequently see his editorials in neuro-ophthalmology through AAO. Dr. Chen is a clinical scientist, NIH-funded, and his work spans across aqueous humor dynamics and optic neuropathy. I greatly appreciate his expertise as a colleague and excited to share a journal club today with him on a couple articles he chose and sharing that expertise with a greater audience. So welcome, Dr. Chen.
Great. Well, I'm very excited to be here to chat about some of these articles that I think are actually very important in neuro-ophthalmology and rest of ophthalmology as well.
We're having a really good time doing these journal clubs, and I love the two articles that you chose today. I think they're really important, very topical for a neuro-op, but also complicated. So I'm glad we have an expert here to kind of break them down. We're going to go through two different articles, one on MOGAD and optic neuritis, and then the other on idiopathic intracranial hypertension. Let's start with the MOGAD one. Break this paper down for us, and then maybe we'll back up a little because I have some optic neuritis type questions I want to go through.
Yeah, John was just awarded, I think, for the fourth year in a short time, Teacher of the Year in Ophthalmology here at Mayo. For me, when I hear these discussions and these antibodies, and whenever I see optic neuritis, I get scared. So I just love having you as a colleague, both for the clinical and the terminology breakdown of these things.
Yeah, we need your educator hat on
exactly.
For this.
Step back and just remind us, NMO and MOGAD and MS, and just share with us what's happened in this field as these terms are so critical, not just in research, but in true clinical care implications.
Oh, absolutely. And so this paper that is selected is essentially the new international criteria for MOGAD, MOG antibody-associated disease. But just to take a step back, it's so important to determine the etiology of optic neuritis. You know, the traditional teaching is you've got optic neuritis and you've got to determine is it multiple sclerosis or not multiple sclerosis. But there's other entities that can cause optic neuritis, like neuromyelitis optica, NMO, and there's MOG antibody-associated disease, or MOGAD. And what's important about when you have a patient with optic neuritis in terms of differentiating the cause of the optic neuritis is it not only impacts the prognosis, it actually impacts the treatment. And that's why it's so important to be able to correctly diagnose a patient with either MS, NMO, or MOGAD when you have a patient with optic neuritis.
It's the whole way that the field has progressed from, like you said, optic neuritis treatment trial, when the question was, is it MS related or not? And that's kind of your first branch point. And then we started talking about NMO. I remember as a medical student, I saw a patient with NMO and we talked about DeVic's disease and this patient had transverse myelitis and it was its whole own clinical entity. And then this MOG-associated disease kind of entered the picture not that long ago. Can you take us through just the clinical changes, how we've diagnosed those, what the diagnosis means? Is it serology? And then you talked about how they have treatment and prognostic differentials and how that can characterize each group. So separate those for us and how we understand those as a clinician.
No, absolutely. And so again, we've known about NMO or DeVic disease for over a century. But in 2004, actually at the Mayo Clinic, they found antibodies against aquaporin-4 that was both a biomarker and a cause of NMO. And so all of a sudden this NMO disorder spectrum actually expanded. It's not just optic neuritis and transverse myelitis and inflammation of the spinal cord, but it can cause other areas of inflammation in the brain, and we could better characterize the disease. And so now it's NMO spectrum disorder, NMOSD. And so again, That's serology based. We've got an amazing assay against aquaporin 4 antibodies. That's essentially 100% specific. But what's interesting is about a quarter of patients with this NMO spectrum disorder phenotype are negative for the aquaporin 4 antibody. And what that means is that there must have been some other antibody floating around that we didn't know. And more recently, antibodies against MOG have been discovered that can also cause optic neuritis, transverse myelitis, a lot of overlapping phenotypes, kind of clinically overlapping, but actually a completely different pathogenesis, different prognosis, different treatment. And so in terms of the history of this MOG antibody, I think the first hint of it was in 2009. So that's a pretty good amount of time ago when Kevin O'Connor first found that, well, maybe this MOG antibody might be a different antibody, different from multiple sclerosis. But it wasn't until 2014, 2015 that it started getting better characterized as optic neuritis is the most common phenotype, transverse myelitis, and some other phenotypes as well. And then actually, just to tell you how new it is, the antibody against MOG wasn't commercially available until the end of 2017
wow.
in the U.S. And that was Mayo Clinic's assay, at least here in the U.S. In Europe, it was available a little bit earlier. But at least in the United States, not until the end of 2017 did we even have a commercially available MOG assay. Now that you've got a MOG assay that you can identify disease, of course, the spectrum really has expanded. And I think that's what this kind of paper touches upon in terms of the international criteria.
So when you see patients in clinic and they have symptoms or you have an optic nerve that fits under what you would classify as an optic neuritis, which patients are you, you know, people that didn't train recently don't really understand, what are you adding to the workup? Have these become such a critical part of a typical workup that now when a patient is sent in here to the Mayo Clinic or elsewhere for optic neuritis, they've become a standard of care, that all of these measurements, for the audience and people that are out and about, explain how critical this has been and just the first order tests, the first things you're thinking about in clinic.
No, absolutely. If you do have a patient with optic neuritis, unless it's classic MS, so if it's a mild optic neuritis and the MRI shows those preventricular white matter lesions, they've got symptoms of multiple sclerosis, that's going to be MS. You know, we always talk about if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, flies like a duck, that's a duck, that's MS. MS is still the most common cause of optic neuritis. You know, it causes about 50% of optic neuritis in a predominantly Caucasian population, whereas MOGAD, it's only about 6%, NMO, it's only about 3%. So MS is going to be far more common. But we should be looking for MOG or NMO in any patient that isn't classic MS, because really, ultimately, it changes prognosis, and the most important thing is it changes treatment. The treatments are completely different between the three different diseases. And so if you incorrectly diagnose an NMO patient with MS or a MOG patient with MS and treat them with an MS disease-modifying treatment, it actually doesn't help at all and potentially can even worsen the disease, at least in terms of NMO.
That's wild. So not classic MS-related optic neuritis, then you're getting aquaporin 4 antibodies, you're getting MOG antibodies, and then differentiating based on that. And then talk to us about how the treatments differ.
Yeah, so again, I think it's so important to look at these antibodies. You think about all the antibodies we used to get, or biomarkers we used to get, like ANA and ACE. Those have like specificity of 80%. You know, these yeah. are really game changers. In terms of treatments with NMO, the attacks are so severe that they can leave patients blind, wheelchair bound, that we're typically treating with very high dose corticosteroids and this treatment called plasma exchange, mm-hmm. where oftentimes patients may require a central line where you're taking their blood and actually removing the pathologic antibodies and giving them back plasma. And so oftentimes with NMO, the attacks are so severe that you need plasma exchange. So that's in the acute setting. With MOG antibody-associated disease, we're treating with very early corticosteroids. And again, that probably leads to better outcomes. And then the patients don't recover, then we can do plasma exchange. And that's in the acute setting. With MS, we found out that from the ONTT that steroids quickens the recovery but doesn't actually change the ultimate outcome. So again, the acute treatments are different. NMO, acute steroids, anaplasma exchange, MOGAD, early steroids. MS, we usually still treat with steroids, but we're telling them it just quickens recovery, doesn't change the ultimate outcome. Probably the most important is the chronic treatment. With MS, they need to be on a disease-modifying therapy because otherwise you're going to get relapsing disease and more disability over time. With NMO, they also have to be on chronic immunotherapy. The treatments are different. We have monoclonal antibodies for NMO that are very effective. Rituximab, enebolizumab, satralizumab, eculizumab, all the mabs. But what's amazing is they show reductions in relapses by up to 94%. So what was once a disease that would put you in a wheelchair or blind you, we have as close to a near cure as possible with, wow, you know, treatments that are so effective. And then the old classic medications for MS, like the interferons, are completely ineffective for NMO and can worsen the disease. Wow. Now we've got MOGAD now. Again, completely different pathophysiology, even though there's a clinical overlap. In these patients, only about 50% of patients are going to relapse. If you treat them early with steroids for an early relapse, usually you can get pretty good recovery. What that means is that if you've got a patient with a single attack and pretty good recovery, we're actually recommending observation without putting them on chronic immunotherapy, mm-hmm, because otherwise you'd be treating, you know, 50% of patients that are never destined to have a relapse again. So again, completely different strategy in terms of when to do treatment. And if a patient has relapsing MOGAD and we know they have to be on some treatment to prevent attacks, the treatment choice is different. Probably treatments like maintenance IVIG and tocilizumab may be better treatments for MOGAD. And the classic treatment that we use for NMO, like rituximab, probably leads to a mild reduction. And the classic treatments for MS are actually ineffective. Mm-hmm. So again, chronic treatment's completely different in our approach.
That is a wonderful backdrop. In that framework, you chose this particular article. The title of the article is Diagnosis of Myelin Oligodendrocyte Glycoprotein Antibody Associated Disease, International MOGAD Panel Proposed Criteria by Dr. Banwell. This was just published here in 2023 in The Lancet Neurology. Why did you pick this article in terms of the importance? I mean, you speak to how critical this is, and I think your even introduction of this disease shapes that. But why was this article so productive? And what were your takeaways as you chose it for our audience today?
Yeah, I think, one, it just shows how far we've come from MOGAD, you know, from not even having a biomarker, not even knowing it existed, to actually having it established as a clear disease that's separate from MS and NMO, and that really highlights it. When it first came out, we didn't even agree on a name. You know, it was called MOG disorder, anti-MOG disease, MOG encephalomyelitis, and now this firmly cements the actual name we're going to be used moving forward, MOG antibody-associated disease, or MOGAD. And then more importantly, it talks about the clinical phenotypes that it can cause. When it first was described, we knew optic neuritis, transverse myelitis, and this thing called ADEM, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis. But we now know that another common phenotype is cortical encephalitis, where patients can get inflammation in the brain, where they can present with seizures, fevers, encephalopathy. Mm-hmm. And so this paper kind of steps through the main clinical phenotypes that MOGAD can cause and kind of the classic features of them. Again, the most common phenotype of MOGAD is optic neuritis, and that's why we care as ophthalmologists. But there's actually features of the optic neuritis that can help differentiate it from MS and NMO. It tends to be bilateral optic neuritis, more disc edema, lots of inflammation of the optic neuron in the MRI. And so these clinical phenotypes kind of help you know or at least raise the suspicion for MOGAD. And this paper really nicely outlines all of that.
One thing that the paper talked about I wanted to ask you is that, so you can make a diagnosis of MOGAD if you have these high MOG antibodies, but what happens if you have a low MOG antibody test and you still think that's what you're dealing with clinically?
Yeah, that's where the paper really delves into the diagnosis here, and it gets a little more complicated. But it's MOG antibody associated disease, so by definition, you need to have a positive MOG antibody. And if you've got a very high titer MOG antibody and any demyelinating attacks affecting the central nervous system, essentially you make your diagnosis of MOGAD. Where it gets a little more tricky is when you've got these lower titer MOG antibodies, you need to have supporting features to kind of make your diagnosis. And that's because the assay is very good, but it's not perfect. So essentially the assay is 98% specific. Mm-hmm. Sounds amazing. Mm-hmm. But we actually went through 2 years of MOG antibody testing at the Mayo Clinic and looked to see how many of them were true positive and how many were a false positive. And again, we got a specificity of 98%. However, if you've got a disease in MOGAD that's tenfold less common than MS, what ends up happening is, even though you've got a specific assay, you end up getting false positives just because MS is so much more common than MOGAD.
Right.
So overall, we found that almost a quarter of patients tested for MOG antibodies were false positive.
Wow.
But at these super high titers like 1 in 1,000, we're batting at 100%.
Okay.
But at these lower titers at 1 to 20, 1 to 40, 50% of them were false positives. And so, again, we can't kind of raise the threshold because then you're going to miss true MAW cases. Mm-hmm. But what it means is if you're at a low titer at 1 to 20, 1 to 40, you want to make sure it's not MS. You want to make sure it's kind of consistent with MOGAD. Otherwise, it could just be a false positive. And that's what this paper does, is it really kind of boils down. If you've got this low titer, 1 to 20, 1 to 40, you not only have to have, let's say, optic neuritis, but a feature of optic neuritis that looks like MOGAD. So the either bilateral, good amount of optic disc edema, good amount of enhancement of the optic nerve, all those features are MOGAD. But if you've got a very mild optic neuritis without disc edema, with a short segment enhancement and a MOG titer of 1 to 20, that's going to be more likely to be multiple sclerosis or some other form of optic neuritis rather than MOGAD.
In those cases where you think this is leaning more toward MS, but let's say you don't have any white matter lesions on MRI, then are you just observing and doing imaging over time to see if it kind of works itself out, or are you treating?
Yeah, so if you're thinking MS, there's some more tests that we can do. Obviously, the periventricular white matter lesions in the brain really help. Mm-hmm. But we typically get MRI of the spine, the cervical and thoracic spine, and we're also looking for little lesions there. Mm-hmm. That can help. Sometimes we'll get a spinal tap and look for positive oligoclonal bands.
Sure.
And that can help. And then if everything is negative, then, you know, sometimes what we'll do is we'll observe and then just repeat an MRI in a year, looking for new white spots. Again, multiple sclerosis is multiple scars. I need to have kind of lesions separated by time and space. So you're looking for that accumulation of scars that make you think this is MS.
You're commenting on how there are certain situations where that you have the disease state, it's indeterminate on which bucket to put it in, and the antibody levels are incredibly high in some buckets, and other patients are a little bit equivocal. Do you suspect that we're just on the tip of our iceberg of other antibodies that are in this, that are playing a role here? Because, you know, certainly we celebrate having a MOG to go look for, but, you know, prior to 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. I mean, do you suspect that this is one of many? I know in thyroid eye disease that Andrea and I care for, we continue to learn about all of the different antibody phenotypes and in terms of the pathophysiology, but also ways of treating that. And so is that the same here? Is MOG just the first of many, do you think? Or have we got our hands around it fairly well for the disease state we're looking at?
No, I think that's a great question. I think there's a couple of things. One, I think the MOG assay will probably improve over time. So those, you know, low assay ones, those low titer ones, we can kind of tease out a little bit better. But more importantly, like you said, I think there are still a plethora of biomarkers to be identified. Again, we had these patients with recurrent optic neuritis that we didn't know about MOG, and it was MOG all along. About a third of recurrent optic neuritis is still idiopathic. And what that means is we it's not MS, it's not NMO, it's not MOG. There's still some antibodies out there. Mm-hmm. You kind of think about how we've come with MOG. Again, we've got aquaporin 4 for NMO, great, great antibody that's essentially 100% specific, but, you know, 25% were negative for aquaporin 4, and now we know that MOG antibodies explains about a third of those. But that means that there's still some more NMO phenotypes that are not explained by MOG or aquaporin 4. So again, there are other antibodies floating around. We just have to identify them.
Amazing. Well, what a review. Great paper. So helpful. Thank you for that. I'm going to switch gears to our second paper, The Effect of GLP-1 Receptor Antibody Exenatide on Idiopathic Intracranial Hypertension, a Randomized Clinical Trial. This was published in Brain just in 2023. Super exciting. These drugs, these GLP-1 receptor antibodies, are sweeping the nation. They're very popular, used for all kinds of things now. And so it'll be great to kind of talk about their use in IIH. Can you break down the study for us?
Yeah, so this was a really fascinating study looking at exenatide. Again, exenatide's actually been around since 2005 for diabetes. Again, it's that GLP-1 receptor agonist. Again, now we're using it for weight loss and a lot of other, it's really getting a lot of popularity. But this was a clinical trial for exenatide versus placebo, where they looked to see if it could lower intracranial pressure. Mm-hmm. And so the thought behind this is done by the UK group in Birmingham, amazing group that's done some amazing research on IIH. But they had a rat model where they showed that exenatide actually lowered cerebrospinal fluid production and could potentially lower ICP. So that's a direct mechanism. And then two, we know that IIH is very dependent on obesity. And again, these GLP-1 receptor agonists cause weight loss. So that's a secondary way that can lower ICP. So in this clinical trial, it was actually a pretty small trial. They had 15 patients, double-blind, randomized between exenatide and placebo. And they had 7 that received exenatide subcutaneous injection twice a day and placebo, just a placebo sub-Q injection twice a day, and then followed them for 12 weeks. Another amazing thing about this trial is that these patients volunteered to actually have a burr hole and actually had an ICP monitor implanted in their brain.
It's wild.
So they could have continuous ICP monitoring at any given time. It's not FDA approved in the US, so it's not something that we can do, but they were able to do that. And so they could actually see how fast the ICP dropped with the treatments. And bottom line is, what they found is within 2.5 hours, the intracranial pressure was lower in the exenatide group compared to placebo. And that lower ICP was maintained for the 12 weeks that they monitored these patients. So really amazing.
A burr hole.
Yeah. Yes,
you know, it's fascinating. You know, so many studies that depend on lumbar puncture and pressure measuring, there's a range, and it fluctuates, position, how it's done. So, yeah, if we could put burr holes in everybody, it'd be so much easier to know if it's working. That is a wonderful way of doing it. It's just quite unique in that regard. Can you go back? You just made a comment there about even in the study in the mice, and it applies to humans. So we know it's lowering pressure in ICP. The thought of primary etiology and phenotype and lowering the pressure versus secondary and weight loss, how do you tease that out?
Really, it's the time course. Yeah, you know, if it's all weight loss, you're going to have it
Fair
at 12
enough.
Weeks.
Yep.
Within 2.5 hours.
Yeah, it's already kicking in.
Yeah, yeah, it was already
probably
kicking in.
Probably a little bit of both.
Exactly. And then, you know, the goal is long term.
Right. Sure. Sure.
It's giving me the weight loss. So
that's fantastic.
Wow. Yeah, that is.
Well, I
striking.
Love doing optic nerve sheath fenestration. So is this going to put me out of a job?
Again, this was a small trial, only 15 patients. Mm-hmm. So it really needs to be replicated in a larger clinical trial. But if it holds true, I think it's going to be really the go-to medication for IH. It's going to probably supplant Diamoxin and topiramate because of all the side effects you have with those treatments.
Well, that was my next question. Well, what are the side effects of this thing?
Well, in terms of any GLP-1 receptor agonist, it causes a little bit of nausea, and you know it really slows down your bowels.
Appetite suppressant,
and again, it's very effective in causing weight loss. For the most part, in this trial, again, small trial, it was very well tolerated. Just some nausea in patients, but otherwise well tolerated. But there was a recent publication in JAMA looking at all GLP-1 receptor agonists and potential side effects, and it was found that there's a higher rate of pancreatitis, bowel obstruction, and gastroparesis. And so again, it's all that GI, it just essentially slows down the motility.
Everything.
And so, you know, there are GI risks. Again, there's a lot of risks for, you know, obesity. And so again, just kind of balancing, you know, risks and benefits.
And this paper looked at exenatide, but just like you said, there's lots of GLP-1 receptor agonists. There's semaglutide and a bunch. Yes. Do we think that they're all gonna have the same effectiveness here? Are they all the same mechanism?
And that's the hope that it will. And actually, some of these other medications actually have a larger reduction in weight than exenatide.
Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps they might even be more effective for IIH.
If we wanted to replicate this study in the U.S. and we couldn't do burr holes, would we just have to get serial lumbar punctures?
You know, I
most
think
likely?
We could just do it clinically. And so essentially the burr hole was there so that they could put in this intracranial monitor. Again, so even if we did a burr hole, we don't have access to that intracranial monitor for continuous monitoring. But I think, you know, you could do it clinically. Essentially, it would be patients that would have enrolled would be patients with papilledema, and you would just actually see, does the papilledema improve over time, using OCT as an objective measure to measure the retinal nerve fiber layer thickness.
Oh, sure.
And of course, monitoring their vision with visual fields and visual acuity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you could do it clinically, and then perhaps a subset would get lumbar punctures, but that'd be addition. Because when we did the IIH treatment trial, when we looked at acetazolamide versus placebo, a little over 50% of the patients actually did volunteer for that repeat lumbar puncture 6 months down the road. So that's something we could do, but wouldn't be mandatory because really clinically you could still prove that it works looking at papilledema improvement.
Right. That makes sense. Do you think this is something you'll start implementing with your patients?
It's
approved. I mean, it'd be off label, kind of, but not if there's a weight loss component.
Correct. So I've been trying in patients that couldn't tolerate acetazolamide or topiramate. The problem is insurance companies. It can be very, very difficult. Mm. And so if they've got diabetes, sometimes I can get it through that. Mm-hmm. But then again, the insurance companies often require you to fail two or three different diabetes medications beforehand. And then, of course, through weight loss, sometimes we can get it approved, but it really depends on insurance companies. So it can be quite difficult.
So next steps in bridging that gap, is it a multi-center research endeavor that would be happening, or what do you foresee?
I really do think it's going to be a multi-center, large, randomized clinical trial, you know, where you enroll 150 patients and actually prove that it works, because then you could have it FDA approved for this indication, and I think it would be a game changer for IIH.
That's terrific. Well, wow, really fantastic articles. Cutting-edge stuff, really exciting stuff in terms of diagnosis, treatment, new treatments. There's always something new in neuro-op. I'm always excited when we talk with you, so thank you so much for joining us, John.
Well, thank you so much. Really enjoyed chatting.
Thank you so much, and look forward to another journal club in the future because of the rewards of these. So
yeah, I love these journal clubs.
Exactly. Thanks for tuning in.
You can find all episodes of the Mayo Clinic Ophthalmology Podcast on our website.
Thank you for listening, and we definitely look forward to sharing more